The last case for argument is United States versus Payen. Ms. Bertrand? Or Mr. Bertrand? Are you Ms. Bertrand?
Yes.
Okay. You're up.
Good morning. My name is Joy Bertrand, and I represent Baldemar Payen. He is requesting a resentencing before the trial court, and the reason is that the trial court's findings as to his particular sentence constitute part of one paragraph from a 17-page sentencing transcript, and that is where the trial court said, "I don't find anything in the guideline construct applicable to Mr. Payen's case as against the facts of his case, as against his prior criminal record, that would suggest that the competing principles found in Section 3553A2 would be nullified if I were to impose a sentence other than what is called for under the guideline construct." That is the extent of his findings about Mr. Payen's specific case. And that is after his trial counsel, at a time, as I note in my briefs, when, as we've talked about all morning with several of the other arguments, a lot was in play after Booker. This was only, I believe, 4 months, 5 months after the Booker decision had been issued, and his lawyer filed a letter to the court and said, "Judge, I can't contest the guideline sentence, but it's unreasonable."
But it isn't unreasonable if it's, I mean, it's presumptively reasonable, is it not, considering that it's at the bottom of the guideline range,
right?
Even though it's 235 months.
I agree. This set of facts is very difficult, and it makes you nervous. And yeah, it makes you uncomfortable. And the thing is about this is that I think, in hindsight, what would have been a better way to proceed for trial counsel would have been to file a specific objection to that four-point offense level increase for the leader organizer. And I would like to address that separately for just a moment. But she did, and under, we've talked about this in Cunningham with Judge Posner, we've talked about this, Judge Rovner, with you and Hawk, that once trial counsel says, "Judge, I don't think it's reasonable. I don't think these guidelines are reasonable." And she didn't just write a letter flatly saying this is crazy. She did have reasons. And she brought up those reasons again in her argument, talking about his childhood, talking about his entire background, and certainly not trying to mitigate the activity in which he was involved, but definitely raising concerns about how this 235-month sentence balances out with the entirety of the case. At that point, I assert she rebutted that presumption. And at that point, she called on the trial court, as we now know, to make specific 3553 findings. And we don't know. We don't know what the trial court factored into this guideline sentence. And I will acknowledge the biggest problem with this case, well, there's a lot of problems with this case, but to me, the primary problem with this case is that trial counsel says at sentencing, "We find the guidelines correctly calculated." And again, I think if you look at it in the context of when this hearing occurred, she didn't have Tiuk to help her. She didn't have the guidance as to what do we do with these new guidelines cases post-Booker. And there is an argument, an intelligent argument that can be made that had she raised an objection about that guideline increase, that four-level increase, that the defendant could have presented a case that the trial court would have considered in at least coming down off the top level of this calculation. And maybe he would have only gotten the middle level of manager but not leader organizer, or maybe he would have gotten
well,
the...
Well, how can he be faulted for not responding to an argument she didn't make?
How can the court be faulted?
Right.
Your Honor, I'm...
You're saying ineffective assistance, basically?
Your Honor, I think that it could be read as an ineffective claim. I, in preparing this brief, consulted with several people about whether or not this was the proper time to raise that or whether a 2255 would be the right venue for that. And, of course, there's a judicial economy issue here of do we just discuss it now and say let's just do it now and take care of this. I believe procedurally that's not the appropriate method. It still is to go back before the trial court and raise it there. But you can't ignore it here. And I think that, if I may just go back to Judge Posner's question, I'm not critical of the trial court in terms of what he was handed. However, the one material difference between the plea agreement and what happened with the probation officer with the PSR, or the PSI in my brief, is this four-level bump. Everything else is consistent. And it would have been another thing, too, if this had been part of the plea that he would plead and admit to this leader organizer that had initially been part of the indictment. He did not. He pled only to the four corners of the count in the plea agreement. So when you have the party saying one number and then you have the PSR coming back nearly 10 years higher, and there's only one reason for that 10-year calculation, I think it's reasonable to say, Judge, it could have been made plainer for the court. If plainer may not be the best word, but we could have made this easier for you. But, Judge, this was the only difference. It had to be addressed. And even if he didn't specifically address that offense level increase, trial counsel had flagged this as a problem, and she had raised facts. She didn't just file a one-page brief saying we claim reasonableness. And so we're saying the record is incomplete, and therefore the court should have developed its record more, at least another paragraph saying, I'm finding this is the appropriate sentence under 3553 for the following reasons: his criminal record, the seriousness of the offense, his role in the offense. That would have even been helpful, but you don't have that. And for those reasons, I think that going back...
I understand what your mitigating factors are.
Your Honor, I don't know that there are mitigating factors under the base offense level that was worked out between the defense and the government. And I think that's one of the reasons the defendant entered into a plea agreement. This was a serious case. However, when you start going into these higher guideline ranges that were outside what was anticipated, even by the government, as it says in its plea agreement, you do have to think, if it's not mitigating, what's adding? What's the aggravating factors? But I would note there are some mitigating factors that the trial court or the trial counsel raised that had to do with his education and his background in Texas. And I understand the courts hear those a lot. And however, here I think she was balancing that with his ability to get employment.
They all have backgrounds like this, don't they?
Not everybody. I've actually got a couple right now that are really intelligent. But I understand it's
no
a common
to
claim.
Show that he was, abnormally vulnerable because of background or something compared to other criminals in his category, right?
I would agree. There's nothing that says he was some type of vulnerable adult or that would, for example, support a downward departure.
I don't know why you're pursuing that. I mean, I understand why you're pursuing, but I wouldn't waste my time on ineffective assistance. I don't see any error here.
I think the error was in not challenging that offense level calculation, because there are
but
facts.
Why? What's wrong with it?
The offense level calculation, the facts of that the defendant admitted to in the plea agreement support as well, lower levels, and I think actually lower levels within 3B1.1.
I don't understand. What do you think is an error in the calculation of the guideline?
I don't think it applies at the highest level.
Why?
I think that is an error.
Why not?
Because, first of all, this is a in the big scheme of drug trafficking, this was a relatively small organization. I'm not saying he didn't move weight
almost
back and forth.
Everything
but
we see is small.
However,
these punishments are savage. That's what
right.
Congress wants.
Perhaps, Your Honor.
You didn't think he's a leader and organizer.
I don't think he's a leader
or
organizer.
Maybe in the middle or something.
He may be in the middle.
Had five people.
Or the court may find, after at least considering it and discussing it, that it's more of a lateral kind of organization where the people work together rather than him being any type of manager. And that I think is wherein the error will lie.
Could I ask you an unrelated question? You're from Arizona, right?
Sorry.
At least that's what your address is.
Yes, I have an Arizona address. I worked up. He asked, so can I answer?
I'm just curious.
Yes, I practiced up. I have an office in Milwaukee as well, and I practiced in Milwaukee for several years before going into private practice.
Okay, well, I just wondered how you got appointed from Arizona. So I guess
yes,
I've
done a lot of work up in this court.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Bertrand, Mr. Koenig.
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Koenig. I appear on behalf of the United States. Good morning. Unfortunately, I don't have an office in Arizona, especially during February and March. I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But it's a pleasure to be arguing against a former colleague, Ms. Bertrand. She basically raises two arguments. The first is that there ought to have been a hearing, or perhaps there ought yet to be a hearing, on the leadership role issue. And the second issue is whether the sentencing judge adequately explained his reasons for the 235-month sentence. So I'll take them in that order. And I would submit, Your Honors, that it's very clear from the factual proffer in the plea agreement that Mr. Payan was a leader or organizer. In fact, I think a child of 10 could probably read that factual proffer and tell you who the leaders of that activity were. They were Payan and Alvarez. They were the ones who were arranging trips to Texas. They were the ones that the FedEx packages of drugs would be brought to. They recruited mules to run up from Racine to Fond du Lac and so forth. And in a sense, I think the court's analysis of this issue can begin and end with that factual proffer. But it is also significant that there was no written objection to the PSR's characterization of Mr. Payan as a leader or organizer. And there was no objection at sentencing. In fact, Mr. Payan's counsel conceded that the guidelines were correctly calculated. I would direct the court to pages 36 and 37 of the appendix in the appellant's brief for the relevant portion of the plea agreement. The last point I'd make on whether there ought to be a hearing on the leader-organizer issue is that one was never requested at any time, much less a hearing at which the government would have to prove leadership beyond a reasonable doubt. And, of course, even if this court were to remand for resentencing, the appropriate standard, according to Dean and other cases of this court, say that the preponderance standard has survived Booker. So the appropriate standard would be preponderance of the evidence. Now, on the second issue, did the sentencing judge say enough about his reasoning for imposing the 235-month sentence, which fell at the bottom of the guidelines range? He did allude briefly to Section 3553 on pages 11 and 12, I believe, of the sentencing transcript. There was a lot of discussion at a sort of general level about sentencing policy. I think that was in response to the sentencing memorandum that had been submitted. And I'd like to talk briefly about the Cunningham case, which is cited in Payan's reply brief. I believe it stands for the proposition that a sentencing judge may not glide over substantial mitigating arguments merely because he or she is imposing a sentence within or at the bottom of the guidelines range. By the same token, this decision says that the failure to address an immaterial or insubstantial or weak argument does not require resentencing. Where is the line between an insubstantial and a substantial sentencing argument? I'm not sure I know, but I think that we're on the safe side of it in this case. And I think if you look at the facts of Cunningham, the comparison with this case is instructive. Here's what the defendant put in front of the sentencing judge in the Cunningham case. He was a combat veteran. He was a good family man. He had no criminal record. His crime was basically hooking a CI up with his marijuana supplier. He wasn't really a cocaine conspirator. He ended up with, I think, $100 out of the deal. And he had some serious psychiatric problems going back many years. Now, weigh against that the factors that Mr. Payan came forward with. He claimed to have had a hard life, and several of his friends, I think, and his ex-wife described him in favorable terms. I would suggest that's fairly run-of-the-mill and doesn't and insubstantial, at least for purposes of Cunningham. And for all these reasons, I'd ask that you affirm the sentence.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you to Ms. Bertrand. And you were appointed, were you not? Well, we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client, and the court will be in recess.